Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating two amazing veterans who both marked their 101st birthdays on February 15th. We'll hear from Albuquerque, New Mexico's Bill Overmeyer in a few moments, but first we have to finish up with Frank Paredes, who told us about the first time he was wounded in World War II, but not the second or third times.
The second time was in the Philippine Islands. That was in Tacloban, Leyte. We landed in Tacloban, Leyte, and across was an island, Samar. And on my boat, I picked up a dead Japanese dead body in between the propellers. So I had to pull in the beach and tie my boat up, you know, and get under water and change propellers. But first chop the body out. It was tangled in both the propellers. So I chopped them out. In the meantime, while the guy was giving me oxygen in my mask, we get a raid, you know, and he pulled the cord, you know, told me that meant the signal for me to get up, you know. So a bomb hits, I'd say maybe about 100, 150 feet, but the concussion on the water, you know, it hurt my ears. That's not when I got wounded. That's when I got up. When I got out, you know, and I was going to try getting my boat off the beach, so I manned my machine gun. And here comes a zero strafing, and one of the bullets got into the cockpit and went circled, you know, round and round, and it hit me here, went around, hit the well deck, yeah. I mean the cockpit, hit another one. And then I got another one back here.
So you got hit on the right rib cage and in the left side of your back, kind of almost simultaneously.
But I mean, that Japanese zero didn't last very long. Because the Navy was there, you know, and the Air Force were there. In fact, I'm lucky that I got out of there because there was bullets flying all over the damn place.
Well, yeah, and it seems to me if you get hit on your side and in your back, there's a lot of organs in there that could have been damaged by that. You're probably pretty fortunate to have survived that.
Right. So anyway, I did get my third wound.
Well, let's finish up the second one first. How bad was it? How much pain were you in? And
I was in a lot of pain, you know, but I had, you know, some sulfanilamide powder, and I had a bandage, you know, had a first aid kit, and I had morphine, give a shot, you know.
You had to take care of yourself.
I took care of myself, yes. Took care of my wounds, and I was fine.
Did you at all consider the possibility that you might not make it out of that?
Yes. I said, maybe this is my time to go. But the big boy up there, you know, he took care of me.
It sure sounds like it. And so that was in the Philippines on Leyte. And then you said a third time you were wounded. Where was that, and how'd that happen?
The third time was in the Philippines again. That was in Ormoc, you know, that was across the Tacloban on the other end of the island.
Ormoc, sir, there's a big horseshoe kind of bay there, right?
Yeah, right. So I got wounded there, too. The same thing, you know, on the boat, you know.
So you're still operating this LCM, and it was aircraft fire again?
Yes. When I got wounded there, I landed on the beach, and I dug in. My LCM, you know, was broached. Couldn't pull it out. So I had to abandon it, went on the beach, and then I dug a hole, you know, in the sand, and then a bomb fell about from here to my van, and I got blown up in the air about maybe 15, 18 feet. And I come back down, and then on the way down, I got hit with a piece of shrapnel right here.
Right under your chin. So the bomb hits 50 feet away, you go sky high, and on your way down, something slices you on the top of your neck, bottom of your chin?
The doctor, he says, Sergeant, he says, I can't operate on you because it's too close to your jugular vein. Says eventually, hopefully, it's going to travel, and it's going to travel away from your jugular vein. So When I got out, it was about maybe 40 years later, I started getting a toothache. So I went to the dentist. He took x-rays. He said, "You got a piece of metal," he says, "in your root canal." Says, "Your tooth has got to be pulled." So he pulled it. And sure as heck, there's a little chip of shrapnel.
So 40 years later, this little, how big would you say, like fingernail size piece of shrapnel?
I'd say about half of a match hit on the matchstick. Okay. It's just a little chip.
He pulls that out of your mouth 40 years later. That you must have gotten quite the kick out of that.
My wife got a kick out of it. I didn't want that as a souvenir. That's why I have 12 shoppers now.
Let me ask you about Honor Flight. What was it like for you to go on this plane with all these other veterans and go see that World War II memorial?
To me, it was beautiful. We were treated like royalty. We had the best of everything. What got me the most, you know, because as a rule, I was Army, but mostly, you know, I feel myself being a Marine because most of my, you know, was with the Marines. So the Marine Memorial reminded me of my brother, my friends, the people that I knew in the Marine Corps, and especially the Code Talkers. The other one was Arlington National Cemetery, because I have two people, real good friends of mine, buried there. One is Junior Vinvois. He got killed in New Guinea. He got the Medal of Honor. And the other one was a real, real good friend of mine, Frank Chavez. He got the Medal of Honor, too, from Anthony, New Mexico. I promised him that I would go visit his family if I made it. So that's what I did. You know, when I got home, I went to Anthony, New Mexico, and met Frank Chavez's family. And that was the hardest thing I had to do. I went and told him, you know, "This is a message from your son. He died like a man. And he died a hero."
Another one of Frank's heroes is his late brother Raul, who volunteered for the first Marine patrol to reach the summit of Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. Frank Paredes is a veteran of the Korean War as well, who has spent decades putting his love for his country on display to any and all who would listen. And last week, just before his 101st birthday, Frank received his COVID-19 vaccination. The same day Frank celebrated birthday number 101 in California, Bill Overmyer was the man of the hour at a parallel celebration in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Bill had signed up for the National Guard to earn some extra cash. While he was studying engineering at the University of New Mexico, he was called to active duty and sent to the Philippines with the 200th Coast Artillery. He was in an anti-aircraft battery protecting Clark Field when the Japanese attacked.
We had rumors that Hawaii had been hit. Some of the guys said, "Yeah, well, we're going to fight them, but it'll take 6 weeks or so, and we'll clean their plow." Well, it didn't take any 6 weeks, and it took much longer, and it was everything we could do to survive. But the whole darn thing had to do with our forces in Washington, D.C., our brains, resolving a conflict with Japan. And this had been going on for several years. We were sending selling scrap metal to Japan. Japan had ambitions. They had beaten the Russians at a naval conflict, and they were confident that they could get what they wanted. They needed oil. They needed steel. They needed knowledge. They'd sent their military men to the United States, and the United States taught them how to fight a war. Mm-hmm. Well, no kidding. That's what happened at Pearl Harbor. Guess what? They used that same lecture to bomb Pearl Harbor. So we knew that things were going to change.
And a lot of people don't realize that war ensued simultaneously in the Philippines when it hit Pearl Harbor, that you guys were under attack basically the same day, right?
That's correct.
Clark Field was hit that same day, although...
It was December the 8th, but it was after the Asiatic Pacific line.
The international date line.
Right.
So it was December 8th in the Philippines, December 7th in Hawaii, but it's the same day you guys are hit.
Roughly 8 hours after Pearl Harbor was hit. We were there all ready for action, and here came some planes over. We heard some planes. We looked up. We saw some ghosts up there. There was 54 of them. We could count them. And they were flying right overhead. Now, was that our plane? We thought it was Navy. And we didn't do anything until we heard some bombs whistling through the air. And here came the bombs. Man alive. Anyway, couldn't wait to commence fire. So we took our reading for the height finder, and information to the M4 director, to the guns. Fire 4 rounds each. That'd be 16 rounds. I gave the order to do that. Well, they fired. The darn things went off about 1,000 feet below the airplanes. After 9 months of training and teaching how to shoot at a target of an airplane, we got into action and we found out that our fuses were World War I fuses, powder train fuses. Believe it or not. They sent us right into the teeth of the enemy with unprepared. Incidentally, we had World War I helmets, steel helmets. We had World War I Springfield rifles, bolt action, 5 shots, and how many more things I can't even think of. We thought we had some pretty nice guns, but they did shoot out pretty fast, about the same velocity as a rifle did. And we thought we knew everything there was to know, but we got an education.
Well, and that's what I'm curious to know, what that felt like that day. Because here you've been preparing for it. You know there's a possibility. Then when war's actually there, it's on your doorstep, it's right in your face, and you're firing at the enemy, and the enemy's bombing you. Did that change anything for you emotionally, mentally? Do you remember what that was like?
It filled us with despair. After the bombers dropped, dive bombers came in, and they started strafing and shooting up different areas. Their main targets were the airport, Clark Field, and the buildings, and several or quite a few of our soldiers were killed in the mess hall and in the buildings and so forth. But we were out in the open in a dug-in trench. Incidentally, anybody that joins the Army or the military ought to learn how to dig a hole in the ground, because that's the safest place you can be. Absolutely. Well, anyway, these dive bombers were coming around strafing, and we had 2 machine guns in our battery, and one of the guys that was a football player from Texas Tech was on my staff, my range staff. He was up on top shooting at the planes with his little handheld machine gun, but he didn't hit anything. We were all shooting with our rifles, or some guys were shooting with their pistols, but we didn't shoot any other planes down until the second day. We were in the north runway of Clark Field. It's clear down at the end, and we were dug in. We had our 4 3-inch guns dug in. The M4 director and the stereoscopic height finder. Incidentally, I was the chief of range section of the aiming, you might say, of the 4-inch guns, and that's the M4 director was the brains for the whole thing. Now, this is before radar. Later on, we discovered that Battery A had been issued some radar, and after they hit us there the first day of war, well, the second day, they 3 planes came in, and they were flying low. The radar told us, we've got 3 boys coming in such and such 1,000 feet. So we matched pointers until we could see them. And then we went visual. They were coming right straight at us. So I turned in. I was on the M4 director. I entered a little correction on the M4 and shortened the target range and the guns going off. So the explosions would be in front of them. They'd have to fly through it. We got 2 out of the 3. The best shooting we had during the whole dang war.
And if you hadn't made that adjustment, you might have gone 0-for-3.
That's right. We were not at Clark Field much longer. A matter of days, in fact. We stayed there at Clark Field another day or so, I guess. Then they moved us out and said, we're moving to Bataan. What's Bataan? Bataan is a peninsula hanging off of the bottom of the main island of Luzon. We went south and we set up for a day or so up at a main bridge at a big river that was just before you get into Bataan. It was a key bridge to allow soldiers from all over the Luzon and the Philippine Islands that converged at that area roughly and then settled and retreated back into Bataan to make a stand against the Japanese. We had thousands of soldiers making that retreat, and they had to go over this river. Mm-hmm. And we knew the Japs were going to want to blow it up.
The bridge up so you couldn't cross the river.
So we protected it.
If not for a twist of fate, he would have ended up on the Bataan Death March, and we might not have had the privilege of hearing his story, much less wish him a happy 101st birthday. You can go to hometownheroesradio.com for photos and more relating to the two birthday boys we're honoring this week. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.